This is part 6 from A Philosophy of Freedom, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path by Rudolf Steiner. This is part 2, Practice, the Reality of Freedom. Chapter 8, The Factors of Life. Let us recapitulate what we have gained through the previous chapters. The world comes to meet me as a multiplicity, a sum of separate details. As a human being, I am myself one of these details, an entity among other entities. We call this form of the world simply the given. And insofar as we do not develop it through conscious activity, but find it ready-made, we call it percept. Within the world of percepts, we perceive ourselves. But if something did not emerge out of this self-percept that proved capable of linking both percepts in general and also the sum of all other percepts with the percept of ourself, our self-percept would remain simply one among many. This emerging something, however, is no longer a mere percept, nor is it, like percepts, simply present. It is produced through activity, and initially appears linked to what we perceive as ourself. But its inner meaning reaches beyond the self. It adds conceptual determinants to individual percepts, but these conceptual determinants relate to one another and are grounded in a whole. It determines conceptually what is achieved through self-perception conceptually, just as it determines all other percepts. It places this as the subject, or capital I, over against objects. This something is thinking, and the conceptual determinants are concepts and ideas. Thus, thinking first expresses itself in the percept of the self, but it is not merely subjective, for the self characterizes itself as subject only with the help of thinking. Such self-reference, in thought, is one way that we determine our personality in life. Through it, we lead a purely conceptual existence. Through it, we feel ourselves as thinking beings. Were it unaccompanied by other ways of determining ourself, this determination of our personality would remain purely conceptual, logical. Then we would be beings whose lives were limited to establishing purely conceptual relationships among percepts, and between percepts and ourselves. Now, if we call the establishment of such a relationship in thought cognition, and the state of the self achieved through it knowledge, then, if the assumption just mentioned applied, we would have to regard ourselves as merely cognizing or knowing beings. But this assumption does not hold. As we have seen, we do not relate percepts to ourselves only through concepts, but also through feeling. Therefore, we are not beings with merely conceptual content to our lives. The naive realist, in fact, sees in the feeling life a more real expression of the personality than in the purely conceptual element of knowledge. And if the matter is judged from that standpoint, this view is quite correct. At first, feeling is exactly similar on the subjective side to the percept on the objective side. Therefore, according to the fundamental proposition of naive realism, (everything that can be perceived is real), feeling guarantees the reality of one's own personality. Yet monism, as understood here, must acknowledge that a feeling, if it is to appear to us in its full reality, requires the same kind of completion as any other percept. For monism, feeling is an incomplete reality that, in the form in which it is given to us at first, does not yet contain its second factor, the concept or idea. This is why feeling, like perceiving, always appears before cognizing. First, we merely feel ourselves as existing, and in the course of our gradual development, we reach the point at which, out of our own dimly felt existence, the self-concept dawns upon us. But what emerges for us only later is originally inseparably united with feeling. This is what makes naive persons believe that existence reveals itself directly in feeling, but only indirectly in knowledge. Exercising the life of feeling will therefore seem more important to them than anything else. They believe themselves to have grasped the pattern of the universe only when they have received it into their feeling. They try to make feeling, not knowing, the means of cognition. Since feeling is something altogether individual, something equivalent to perception, philosophers of feeling make something that has significance only within their own personality into the principle of the universe. They try to permeate the entire universe with their own selves. What monism, as described in this book, attempts to grasp conceptually, the philosophers of feeling seek to achieve with feeling. They see that kind of connection with things as more immediate. This tendency, the philosophy of feeling, is often called mysticism. A mystical view based solely on feeling errs in wanting to experience what it ought to know. It wants to make something that is individual, feeling, into something universal. Feeling is a purely individual act. It is a relationship of the outer world to our subject, insofar as that relationship finds expression in a purely subjective experience. There is yet another expression of the human personality. Through its thinking, the I, capital, participates in general universal life. Through thinking, it relates percepts to itself, and itself to percepts, in a purely conceptual way. In feeling, it experiences a relationship of the object to its subject. But in willing, the reverse is the case. In willing, too, we have a percept before us, namely that of the individual relation of ourself to what is objective. And whatever is not a purely conceptual factor in our will is just as much a mere object of perception as anything in the outer world. Yet here, too, naive realism believes that it has before it a far realer kind of existence than can be attained through thinking. In contrast to thinking, which formulates the event only afterward in concepts, naive realism sees an element in the will in which we are immediately aware of an event or cause. From this point of view, what the I achieves through its will is a process that is experienced immediately. Adherents of this philosophy believe that in the will they have hold of a corner of the world process. They believe that in willing we experience a real event quite immediately, while we can only follow other events from the outside. They make the form of existence in which the will appears within the self into an actual principle of reality. Their own willing appears to them as a special case of the universal world process, and the universal world process appears as a universal will. Here the will becomes a world principle, just as feeling becomes a cognitive principle in mysticism. This point of view is called the philosophy of the will, or thelism, thelism. It makes something that can be experienced only individually into a constitutive factor of the world. The philosophy of will can no more be called science than can the mysticism of feeling, for both maintain that to permeate the world with concepts is inadequate. In addition to a conceptual principle of existence, both demand a real principle as well. There is some justification in this. But since we can grasp these so-called real principles only through our perception, the claims of both mysticism of feeling and philosophy of the will are identical with the view that we have two sources of knowledge, thinking and perceiving, the latter expressing itself as individual experience in feeling and in will. According to this view, since what flows from one source, our experiences, cannot be received directly into what flows from the other, thinking, both kinds of cognition, thinking and perceiving, remain side by side, without any higher mediation between them. Beside the conceptual principle attainable through knowledge, there is supposed to exist a real principle of the world that can be experienced, but not grasped by thinking. In other words, because they subscribe to the proposition that what is directly perceived is real, mysticism of feeling and the philosophy of will are both types of naive realism. Yet compared to the original naive realism, they commit the further inconsistency of making a specific form of perceiving, feeling, or willing into the sole means of cognizing existence. But they can do so only by subscribing to the general proposition that what has been perceived is real. On that basis, however, they would also have to ascribe an equivalent cognitive value to external perceiving. The philosophy of will becomes metaphysical realism when it transfers the will into those realms of existence where immediate experience of it is not possible in the same way as it is in one's own subject. It assumes the existence outside the subject of a hypothetical principle, the sole criterion for whose reality is subjective experience. As metaphysical realism, the philosophy of the will succumbs to the criticism given in the previous chapter, which the contradictory aspect of every metaphysical realism must recognize and overcome, that the will is only a universal world process to the extent that it relates to the rest of the world conceptually. The end of chapter 8. This is the addendum to the new edition, 1918. The difficulty of grasping thinking in its essence by observing it consists in this. When the soul wants to bring it into the focus of attention, this essence has all too easily already slipped away from the observing soul. All that is left for the soul, then, is the dead abstraction, the corpse of living thinking. If we look only at this abstraction, we can easily feel drawn to the mysticism of feeling or the metaphysics of will, which seems so quote-unquote full of life. We find it strange if anyone seeks to grasp the essence of reality in quote-unquote mere thoughts. But whoever truly manages to experience life within thinking sees that dwelling in mere feelings or contemplating the element of the will cannot even be compared with, let alone ranked above, the inner richness and the experience, the inner calmness and mobility in the life of thinking. It is precisely the richness, the inner fullness of experience that makes its reflection in normal consciousness seem dead and abstract. No other activity of the human soul is as easily misunderstood as thinking. Feeling and willing warm the human soul, even when we look back and recollect their original state, while thinking all too easily leaves us cold. It seems to dry out the life of the soul. Yet this is only the sharply contoured shadow of the reality of thinking, a reality interwoven with light, dipping down warmly into the phenomena of the world. This dipping down occurs with a power that flows forth in the activity of thinking itself, the power of love in spiritual form. One should not object that to speak of love in active thinking is to displace a feeling, love, into thinking. This objection is actually a confirmation of what is being said here. For whoever turns toward essential thinking finds within it both feeling and will, and both of these in the depths of their reality. Whoever turns aside from thinking toward pure feeling and willing loses the true reality of feeling and willing. If we experience thinking intuitively, we also do justice to the experience of feeling and will. But the mysticism of feeling and the metaphysics of will cannot do justice to the penetration of existence by intuitive thinking. Those views all too easily conclude that it is they who stand within reality, while intuitive thinkers, devoid of feeling and estranged from reality, form only a shadowy, cold picture of the world in abstract thoughts. End of the addendum. Chapter 9. The Idea of Freedom. For cognition, the concept of a tree is determined by the percept of a tree. Faced with a specific percept, I can select only a very specific concept out of the general conceptual system. The connection between a concept and a percept is indirectly and objectively determined by thinking about the percept. The percept's connection with its concept is recognized after the act of perception, but their belonging together is determined by the situation itself. The process presents itself differently when we examine cognition itself, or the relationship between human beings and the world through cognition. In the preceding discussion, an attempt was made to show that it is possible to clarify this relationship through unprejudiced observation. A proper understanding of such observation leads to the insight that thinking can be beheld directly as a self-enclosed entity. Those who find it necessary to explain thinking as such by appealing to something else, such as physical processes in the brain or unconscious mental processes lying behind observed conscious thinking, misunderstand what the unprejudiced observation of thinking provides. To observe thinking is to live during the observation immediately within the weaving of a self-supporting spiritual entity. We could even say that whoever wants to grasp the essence of the spirit in the form in which it first presents itself to human beings can do so in the self-sustaining activity of thinking. In examining thinking itself, two things coincide that otherwise must always appear as separated: concepts and percepts. If we do not understand this, the concepts developed in response to percepts will seem to us to be shadowy copies of these percepts, while the percepts themselves will seem to present us with true reality. We will also build a metaphysical world for ourselves on the pattern of the perceived world. Following the style of our mental imagery, we will call this metaphysical world the atomic world, the world of the will, or of the unconscious spirit, and so forth, and we will fail to see how in all of this we have built up only a hypothetical metaphysical world on the pattern of our perceptual world. But if we see what is really present in thinking, we will recognize that only one part of reality is present in the percept, and that we experience the other part, which belongs to it and is necessary for it to appear as full reality, in the permeation of the percept by thinking. We shall then see in what appears in consciousness as thinking not a shadowy copy of reality, but a spiritual essence that sustains itself. Of this spiritual essence, we can say that it becomes present to our consciousness through intuition. Intuition is the conscious experience within what is purely spiritual of a purely spiritual content. The essence of thinking can be grasped only through intuition. Only when by means of unprejudiced observation we have wrestled through to a recognition of this truth about the intuitive essence of thinking can we obtain a clear path to insight into the human organization of body and soul. We then recognize that this organization can have no effect on the essence of thinking, even though the facts initially seem to contradict this. In normal experience, human thinking appears only in and through the organization of body and soul. This organization makes itself felt so strongly in thinking that its true significance can only be seen by someone who has recognized that nothing of that organization plays a part in the essential nature of thinking. But such a person will also see what a peculiar kind of relationship exists between this human organization and thinking. For our organization has no effect on the essence of thinking, but rather retreats when the activity of thinking appears. Our organization suspends its own activity. It makes room, and in the space that has been made free, thinking appears. The effective essence in thinking has a double function. First, it represses the human organization's own activity, and second, it replaces that activity with itself. Even the first of these, the repression of the bodily organization, is a result of thinking activity, of the part of that activity that prepares the appearance of thinking. We can see from this in what sense thinking is reflected in the bodily organization. Once we see this, we will no longer be able to mistake the significance of that reflection and take it for thinking itself. If we walk over softened ground, our footsteps dig into the earth. We are not tempted to say that the footprints are driven upward from below by forces in the ground. We will not attribute to those forces any share in the origin of the footprints. Similarly, if we observe the essence of thinking without prejudice, we will not attribute any part of this essence to traces in the bodily organism that arise because thinking prepares its appearance by means of the body. Footnote: in writings subsequent to this one, the author has shown how the above view has been confirmed in psychology, physiology, etc. Here only what comes from the unprejudiced observation of thinking itself was to be addressed. End footnote. Here a significant question emerges. If the human organization plays no part in the essence of thinking, what significance does this organization play in the totality of the human being? The answer is that what happens in human organization, as a result of thinking, has nothing to do with the essence of thinking, but it does have something to do with the origin of I consciousness out of thinking. The real I, capital, certainly lies in thinking's own essence, but I consciousness does not. Anyone who observes thinking without prejudice sees this as the case. The I is to be found in thinking, but I consciousness appears because the traces of thinking activity are engraved in general consciousness as characterized above. Parenthesis, I consciousness, therefore, arises through the bodily organization. But let us not confuse this with the claim that I consciousness, once arisen, remains dependent on the bodily organization. Once arisen, it is taken up into thinking, and thereafter shares in thinking's spiritual being. Parenthesis. I consciousness is based on the human organization from which our acts of will flow. Following the preceding discussion, insight into the connection between thinking, the conscious, let me read that again. Following the preceding discussion, insight into the connection between thinking, the conscious I, and acts of will can be achieved only if we first observe how an act of will proceeds from the human organization. For an individual act of will, we must consider both the motive and the motive power. The motive is a conceptual or mentally pictured factor. The motive power is the factor of willing that is conditioned directly within the human organization. The conceptual factor, or motive, is the momentary determining principle of willing. The motive power is the abiding determining principle of the individual. A motive can be a pure concept or a concept with a specific relation to perceiving, that is, a mental picture. By affecting a human individual and by determining that individual to act in a certain direction, general and individualized concepts, mental pictures, become motives of willing. Yet one and the same concept or one and the same mental picture has different effects on different individuals. The same concept or mental picture can cause different people to perform different acts. Willing, then, is not merely the result of the concept or mental picture, but also of the individual human makeup. We shall call this individual makeup, following Edward von Hartmann, the characterological disposition. The way in which concepts and mental pictures work upon someone's characterological disposition gives that person's life a specific moral or ethical stamp. Our characterological disposition is shaped by the more or less lasting content of our subjective life, in other words, by the content of our mental pictures and feelings. Whether or not a mental picture currently arising within me stimulates my willing depends on how it relates itself to the rest of my mental pictures, as well as to my idiosyncrasies of feeling. My store of mental pictures is determined, in turn, by the sum of concepts that have come into contact with percepts in the course of my individual life. That is, by the concepts that have become mental pictures. These, again, depend on my greater or lesser capacity for intuition and on the range of my observations, that is, on the subjective and objective factors of my experiences, on my inner character, and on my life setting. My feeling life is especially important in determining my characterological disposition. Whether or not I make a particular mental picture or concept or motive for action depends upon whether it gives me joy or pain. These are the elements to be considered in an act of will. The immediate mental picture or concept becomes a motive and determines the goal or purpose of my willing. My characterological disposition determines whether or not I will direct my activity toward that goal. The mental picture of taking a walk during the next half hour determines the goal of my activity. This mental picture, however, is elevated into a motive of willing only if it encounters a suitable characterological disposition. That is, if in my life to date I have developed mental pictures of, for example, the usefulness of taking walks and the value of health, and further, if the mental picture of taking walks is linked in me with feelings of pleasure. Thus, we must distinguish between 1. The possible subjective dispositions that are suited to making specific mental pictures and concepts into motives, and 2. The possible mental pictures and concepts that are capable of influencing my characterological disposition so that an act of will results. The former represent the motive powers, the latter the goals of morality. By identifying the elements that compose an individual life, we can discover the motive powers of morality. The first level of individual life is perceiving, particularly the perceiving of the senses. In this region of individual life, perceiving is immediately, without any intervening feeling or concept, transformed into willing. The motive power under consideration here is simply called drive. Satisfaction of our lower, purely animal needs, hunger, sexual intercourse, etc., occurs in this way. The special characteristic of the life of the drives is the immediacy with which the individual percept activates our willing. This immediacy, originally belonging only to the lower sense life, can also be extended to the percepts of the higher senses. We react to the percept of some event in the external world without further reflection and without linking a special feeling to it, as occurs in conventional social behavior. We call the motive power here tact or moral taste. The more such an immediate reaction to a percept occurs, the more suited the person in question will be to act purely under the influence of tact. That is, tact becomes the characterological disposition. The second sphere of human life is feeling. Particular feelings accompany percepts of the external world. These feelings can become motive powers for action. If I see a hungry person, my compassion can form the motive power to act. Such feelings include shame, pride, sense of honor, humility, remorse, compassion, vengeance, gratitude, piety, loyalty, love, and duty. Footnote: a complete catalogue of the principles of morality from the standpoint of metaphysical realism can be found in Edward von Hartmann's Die Phänomenologie des sittlichen Bewusstseins. And footnote. Finally, the third level of life is thinking and mental picturing. Through mere reflection, a mental picture or concept can become a motive for action. Mental pictures become motives because in the course of life we constantly link certain goals of our will to percepts that recur repeatedly in more or less modified form. Therefore, people who are not without experience are always aware, along with certain percepts, of mental pictures of actions they themselves have performed or seen others perform in similar cases. These mental pictures float before them as defining patterns for all later decisions. They become part of their characterological disposition. We can call this motive power of the will practical experience. Practical experience merges gradually into purely tactful action. This happens when certain typical pictures of actions have become so firmly connected in our consciousness with mental pictures of certain situations in life that we may, in any given instance, skip over all deliberation based on experience and go immediately from the percept into willing. The highest stage of individual life is conceptual thinking, without reference to a specific perceptual content. We determine the content of a concept out of the conceptual sphere through pure intuition. Such a concept initially contains no reference to specific percepts. If we enter into willing under the influence of a concept referring to a percept, that is to say, a mental picture, then it is this percept that determines our willing through the detour of conceptual thinking. If we act under the influence of intuitions, then the motive power of our action is pure thinking. Since it is customary in philosophy to designate the capacity for pure thinking as, quote-unquote, reason, we are fully justified in calling the moral driving force characteristic of this stage practical reason. The clearest account of this motive force of the will has been given by Kreyenbuhl. I count his essay on the topic among the most significant creations of contemporary philosophy, particularly of ethics. Footnote: Philosophische Monatshefte, Band 18, Heft 3, 1882, available as Kreyenbuhl, Ethical Spiritual Activity in Kant, translated by Harold Jürgen, Spring Valley Mercury Press. Kreyenbuhl was a Swiss scholar, teacher, journalist, seeker after truth, and lecturer on Platonic philosophy. He wrote, among others, on Schiller, Plato, Pestalozzi, the Gospel of St. John, and the History of Philosophy. End footnote. Kreyenbuhl calls the motive power in question practical a priori, that is, an impulse to act flowing directly from my intuition. Clearly, such an impulse no longer belongs, strictly speaking, to the realm of characterological dispositions. For what is active here as the motive power is no longer something merely individual in me, but the conceptual and therefore universal content of my intuition. As soon as I recognize the justification for making this content the basis and starting point for an action, I enter into willing, regardless of whether the concept was already present in me beforehand or only entered my consciousness immediately before the action, that is, regardless of whether or not it was already present in me as disposition. An act of will is real only if a momentary impulse of action influences the characterological disposition in the form of a concept or mental picture. Such an impulse then becomes a motive of willing. The motives of morality are mental pictures and concepts. There are ethicists who also see a motive of morality in feelings. They claim, for example, that the aim of moral action is to promote the greatest possible amount of pleasure in the acting individual. But only the mental picture of pleasure, not pleasure itself, can become a motive. The mental picture of a future feeling, but not the feeling itself, can affect my characterological disposition. For the feeling itself is not present in the moment of action. Rather, it must first be produced through the action. The mental picture of one's own or another's well-being is quite properly recognized as a motive of willing. The principle of producing through one's actions the greatest amount of pleasure for oneself, that is, of attaining individual happiness, is called egoism. This individual happiness is sought either through thinking ruthlessly only of one's own welfare and striving for it even at the expense of the happiness of other individuals, pure egoism, or through promoting the good of others because one hopes for indirect advantages from their happiness, or through fear of endangering one's own interests by harming others, morality of prudence. The particular content of egoistic moral principles will depend on what mental picture we form of our own or others' happiness. We will determine the content of our egoistic striving according to what we regard as good in life: luxurious living, hope of happiness, deliverance from various evils, and so forth. The purely conceptual content of an action should be seen as a different kind of motive. Unlike the mental picture of one's own pleasure, this content relates not just to a single action, but to the derivation of an action from a system of moral principles. These moral principles can regulate ethical conduct in the form of abstract concepts, without an individual's worrying about the origin of the concepts. We then feel that our subjection to the moral concept, which hovers over our actions as a commandment, is simply a moral necessity. We leave the establishment of this necessity to whoever demands our moral subjection, that is, to whatever moral authority we recognize: the head of our family, the state, social custom, ecclesiastical authority, divine revelation. A special kind of moral principle is involved when the commandment does not announce itself to us through outer authority, but from within ourselves. We may call this moral autonomy. We then hear within ourselves the voice to which we must submit. The expression of this voice is conscience. This is the end of this part of the recording. I'm on page 146, starting with paragraph 20 of chapter 9, which I will finish chapter 9 in the next reading.